finances together. We're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 34. And I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 34 and call Andrea Meyer. Would you come up, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to Senate Bill 34. Two promises. Someone said you guys assumed I might speak for an hour. No, that won't happen. And I won't be reading for my testimony, so I provide that for the record. I'm going to try to highlight the many concerns we have about this. I know I testified before a few of you before about previous editions of this, and, of course, in the past sessions we opposed this. And while I recognize there have been some changes to this legislation, they are not sufficient at all to address ACLU's concerns and do not go to a place where we would ever consider even being neutral on this bill. It still interferes with the lawful private medical decisions, and it really turns all of us into suspected drug abusers. Yeah, I've been talking to this bill about this bill in public for the last few years, and I have not encountered one person when I explain that this is attempting to deal with people who are abusing drugs and providing this opportunity, when I tell them what it does, that they are not alarmed about the government databasing their lawful prescription drug use. Now, the bill contains the language that this is controlled substances schedules 2, 3, and 4. And for many of us, including myself, without knowing what those were, I think those are drugs that other people take. Not me, not most people. But when I went to review what these drugs included, I found out it includes Ambien. Ambien is used as a hypnotic for sleep. Many people who fly on airlines use it. Many people who have any sleep problems use it. Undoubtedly, many people in this building use it. It includes Xanax, a frequently prescribed anxiety medicine. It includes codeine. Every time we go to the dentist and have anything done, we're probably going to get something with codeine in it. And it includes Ritalin. Over the weekend, I talked to my sister-in-law, who is a child psychiatrist. I said, is Ritalin still frequently being prescribed for children? Absolutely, was her response. So we are going to database a lot of people in this building, a lot of children. Indeed, the proponents, when they testified, hidden in their testimony was estimates based on state's data and the population of Oregon, which is about 3.5 million, indicate that the system will log a minimum of 2 million controlled substance prescriptions annually, and the numbers may reach 5 million or more. I mean, who's not going to be on this database eventually? I really have to ask. This fundamentally interferes with our doctor-patient relationship, which is unique in our society. When we talk to our doctor about things that we do not want to share with our friends or with our family, we do not, many of us, talk about the prescriptions we are on. But we are interfering by having the government monitoring and creating a database of that information. You know, former, well, he's now deceased, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brandeis wrote in 1890, that the right to privacy is the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized man. It is a cherished right that's under attack. And the primary culprit is government and the expansive and increased use of technology, which is often premised on doing us good, but can create far more harm and risk and danger to all of us. Now, the proponents have frequently talked about, year after year and hearing after hearing and in the maps, that Oregon is an island amongst all the states surrounding it. This is not true. Washington State does not have this law. They have a requirement for licensing, but they do not have a patient database. It is true they have a bill in this session. I've asked my counterpart up there. The bill's not moved as far as I know. We are not an isolated island, and I would hope that we would keep that in mind when there's testimony about how Oregon is alone in the western states. I want to talk about security breaches. Because when you create a database and when you put private personal information on it, it becomes a source for those who want to take that information. When we talk about security breaches, we talk about online, through emails, data transmission, hacking, compromised passwords, stolen equipment, lost equipment, illegitimate access by former employees, and dishonest insiders. Now, every time I prepare for this hearing, I always go to the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse to see where we are in our data breach history. Since 2005, this are, you know, hundreds and thousands of breaches across the country. But let's focus a little bit more here and now. Since 2007, January 1, there have been 49 reported breaches across our country in 50 days. I want to highlight only a few. Clay High School in Oregon City. On January 25th, a former high school student obtained sensitive staff and student information through an apparent security breach and was copied on an iPod. I like that sort of generational inclusion on that one. And on an iPod, it included the names, date, birth dates, and social security number, addresses, and phone numbers. January 25th, Ohio Board of Nursing. Twice the website posted the name of new licensees and their social security numbers, even though they were not supposed to do that. January 26th, Indiana Department of Transportation. See, I'm emphasizing here, these are public government entities. Also, Social Security. Anthem Blue Cross. On January 26th, cassette tapes containing customer information were stolen from a locked box held by one of its vendors. The pharmacy board will use a vendor in this and will indicate that they have all the custody and control, but you are using a vendor, and we all know there can be breaches both internally and through the vendor. February 2nd, Massachusetts Department of Industrial Accidents, a former state contractor, allegedly accessed a workers' compensation data file, and again, stole personal information. The most recent one you may have heard about, it's in the news, I think, even today, was the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs' continued expansion of the number of breaches, 1.3 million doctor billing information, and 500,000 veterans. And I will not read any more, but one a day. Now, the proponents also tell you, well, but we've had no breaches in our pharmacy databases across the country. That begs the question. Until ChoicePoint was hacked into and lost a lot of their stuff and had a huge data breach, it was only because California had passed a law that required that Californians were to be notified, that the rest of the country learned about this. I was checking today to see how many states since that time have passed legislation, and I can't tell you the exact number, but I was looking through on the legislator site, was a number of bills introduced and never going anywhere. So many states don't have the right to know. So if there's a data breach from a pharmacy board or a pharmacy database, there's no obligation, probably in most of the states that have these, to tell you, to notify you. And you won't necessarily know if there you do have identity theft issues arising in your personal life that the source was from that. It may not be clear. So I don't feel any more secure today or tomorrow with the knowledge that maybe no other state has had a breach. From the list of the government and private sectors, no one is immune from it. And the amount of money that they've put into this proposal year after year continues to alarm me that there is certainly not sufficient resources being put in here, $150,000 a year to $175,000, I believe, or maybe by any name, I'm not sure, that we're going to even begin to build a database that provides necessary security. Now, I thought it was interesting, and I know that Senator Moore said, I think I've seen an amendment, but I thought it was interesting that year after year I testify about the fact that how are they going to database us with a unique identifier? Our name, our date of birth, and our address are insufficient. And I found it a little alarming that in Senate Bill 34, if you, first page, it talks about you shall report to the pharmacy board your name, address, and date of birth of the patient. It's all really clear there. And then the name of the drug, the name of the practitioner, the various codes, date of origin of prescription, date of controlled substance dispense, and quantity. None of these things get to the unique identifier of individuals other than name, date, and address. Oh, H, other relevant information as required by rules adopted by the State Board of Pharmacy. Now, a few months ago, I was invited to attend. The Pharmacy Board brought out an expert who's a lawyer, and she speaks on these issues. And I said to her, well, what are states using as a unique identifier? Social Security number was her answer. Now, if this bill goes forward with the Social Security number, we're greatly alarmed. If it gets removed, that removes one aspect of our concern. It certainly does not address our other concerns. And more importantly, I'd still like to know how the Pharmacy Board will assure unique identifiers. Now, law enforcement. There's been a lot of talk that this bill really is not intended to be for law enforcement, and we ban using the reports as evidence in the civil or criminal court. Okay. But you can use it for investigative purposes to lead to information that you can then use as evidence in court. There is nothing that bans law enforcement from getting involved. As far as I know, and I have never had the question answered to me so far, and maybe others on this panel know up here, whether if you believe a criminal action is going to be happening, that you suspect someone is engaged in criminal action, whether even under HIPAA you're precluded from ringing up law enforcement. Yeah, obviously this information, we are told, can be databased because it's not a HIPAA violation because it's the law, but doctors, pharmacists, or others are going to be potentially, maybe wrongly, given information that they suspect someone might be engaged in criminal conduct. So we continue to be quite alarmed that there will be a process, and I think you saw in the report, I mean, 8-9% is used for law enforcement, so we just need to be clear. This is not inaccessible to law enforcement. This is not, we are not protected from law enforcement getting involved in the information coming out of and as a part of being collected in this database, even if they can't use the records in court. And they can subpoena them with a court order, get a court order, okay? So now we've added a court order. Well, that's great for Oregon law enforcement. But our federal government no longer has such requirements in every situation. The DEA, the NSA, they get security letters through the FBI. The head of the FBI can issue an order, and it's included medical records. A national security letter is what it's called. And a national security letter produced to you or any other entity, first of all, cannot be disclosed by the recipient. And ACLU's fought that because the libraries would receive them. And they couldn't even necessarily talk to their counsel about it. There's no court oversight. So I just want to raise the understanding, sometimes when we create these and we think we're putting protections in, they don't exist for everyone in the playing field and not for the federal government. Now the proponents talk about the purpose of this is really intervention. We're really trying to deal with providing opportunities for doctors to interface with their patients to provide intervention. Well, there's no money here or anything else I've seen for drug treatment. If we're going to try to create a system, where is the part of pharmacy with a proposal to increase the necessary funding for what we hope are more and more people who will want to get drug treatment programs? Now, what if you're wrongly identified? Let me give you the scenario. It's Friday night. You've gone to the pharmacy for your loved one. It's a necessary prescription. They're in crisis. You need to get it filled. The pharmacy runs it and says, we're sorry, but your loved one appears to be on this database in a manner that we cannot provide you this drug tonight. But you can call the Board of Pharmacy on Monday morning, or if it's like today, probably Tuesday morning, and see if you can fix the problem here. We know human error and databases get it wrong. Let's just talk to all the people, including Senator Dave Nelson, who are on the no-fly list. You can get on these lists wrongly. It's just impossible almost to get off of it. So what happens when human error occurs? Also, what happens if your personal private medical information is wrongly released to someone else? you know, somehow a mess up in the name and your information got released to the doctor or pharmacist, actually, you'll never know that someone else is now looking at that information. And when we're talking about this, the law, the bill requires, allows for release to other states with a similar database system. And all they need to have is equivalent security protections. And the Board of Pharmacy will determine that. Now, I'm a little skeptical of that. And I'll tell you why. Because as you've heard already, this bill has been before you session after session. This is the first session that the bill contains languages that says they shall create a secure database. Last session, the bill said they shall database this information and they may set up safeguards. And I know that a number of you looked at that and went, that's not good. I think it was during the interim testimony, and it now was changed to shall. To me, that's not a good track record to know that the security systems are at the utmost top of our Board of Pharmacy's mind, or that they had the skill set to evaluate another state's safeguards. I don't know what information the other state will give in terms of what protections they have. They might want to keep that close in, both because they're either inadequate or because of breach and security issues. But yet we're going to turn it over to another state. And there was actually testimony about these shared state databases that they're looking exploring. And that just alarmed me to no end, because we're going to eventually move to, what, a 50-state shared database where the information is circulated and potentially not protected. Let's say Oregon does a great job of protecting it, but employees in other jurisdictions may not. Finally, immunity. As long as there's good faith attempts to protect the information, there is blanket immunity for everyone in this bill. So there is no recourse for you. There's no recourse if you show up Friday night and you're wrongly told you can't have that drug and you or your loved ones suffer damages. There's no recourse if your information gets out there about your private medical information or your unique identifier information. You have no obligation to know. You have no right to know that it's even happened, let alone to take steps, be it the Board of Pharmacy, be it the physicians, be it the pharmacists, any of these folks. As long as they engage in good faith efforts, they are immune. That's not good enough for us. You know, we need to have full protections on this, and you cannot have it. I wanted to show you just, as an aside, you all may have read about a year ago, July, the Oregonian, huge story about exposed to ID theft. And the cases range from government agencies to colleges to businesses. It says government business must end sloppy practices and do a better job of protecting data. I would suggest that even though this was written in July, since there's been 49 breaches in the last 50 days, it's not happened yet. We are talking about our lawful, private medical information. And despite the purported good this technology is intended to be used for in this purpose, we believe that the government has no right to know and monitor our lawful prescriptions and to start turning all of us into potential drug-seeking abusers until we prove ourselves otherwise. I would urge you not to pass this bill out. I would urge you, if you are, that you consider sending it to the Commerce Committee, the Consumer Committee, or maybe it is the Commerce Committee, Senator Przanski's committee, which is in fact dealing with all these issues this session. If you're serious about moving this bill and you're serious about the safeguards that I've raised, then let's have further discussion with the committee that is looking to all these issues. But I need to leave you with the fact that I would urge you not to move this bill out. If you can talk to your constituents and find anyone who says to you, even when you tell them the good reasons for it, that they're okay when they're going to be databased or their children will be databased, I would suggest to you that really won't happen. It's not happened to anyone I've talked to. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
A stunned silence or a convinced silence? Thank you all.
Or just silence.
Okay. Dana, did you want... Oh, were we going to
I'm here to respond.
Oh, okay, okay.
Only if it's you.
Okay. Michael Douglas, would you come up, please? Okay, yeah.
Gary didn't recognize me. I don't have a white coat on.
I was looking for
a white shirt. My name is Mike Douglas. I'm a registered pharmacist in the state of Oregon. I've been registered for 40-plus years. You'll be glad to know that I received my registration when I was 6, so I'm only 46. I own Mike's Medical Pharmacy in Newburgh, and I also own Mike's Long-Term Pharmacy in Newburgh. Mike's Medical Pharmacy is a retail outlet. Mike's Long-Term Pharmacy is a closed-door facility that only dispenses medications to group homes, nursing homes, and alcohol drug treatment centers. I've worked in the medical field as a pharmacist in drug treatment facilities since 1985. I currently am on the medical staff at Hazleton Springbrook, which is a drug treatment facility in Newburgh. And I'm also on the medical staff at Beyond Addictions, which is a facility in Tigard. The thing that I am here to try to explain and try to talk to you about has some to do with pharmacy, but more to do with my other coat, which is being on a medical staff of a drug treatment center. We, in our field, in the drug treatment side, have a very, very strong feeling that we need to have some help determining what's going on with drug utilization. And we have looked at a lot of things that we could try to do within our own realm, but the reality of it is there's no coordination between medical staffs on the outside of our facilities and our medical staffs within the facility. And what I'm talking about is the fact that, first of all, there has to be an understanding of what addiction is. And addiction is compulsive behavior, which basically means they want what they want, and they want it when they want it. And what happens to us in the pharmacy is we get caught in a catch-22. We get caught because we have no way to determine whether somebody's coming in with a prescription for 40 or 60 of opiate or a benzo, and that they, if it's the first time we've seen them, we don't know whether these people have gotten it legally or illegally. And there are times when, you know, you just kind of have that feeling after you've worked in the treatment field as long as I have, you become somewhat suspicious, unfortunately. But I found out a long time ago that the one trait about addicts, whether they be alcoholics or whether they be using drugs, is the fact they have a tendency to be less than honest. And they have a charisma about them. And when they come in, unfortunately, I pick up that charisma right away. Now, that I don't label them right away that maybe there's a problem, but I start feeling uneasy. And right now, I have no way to substantiate whether or not they are doing what they say they're doing. And let me give you a couple examples. I had a patient in treatment 5 years ago. The guy had signed 6 contracts with 6 different physicians in 6 different towns. He was obtaining from those 6 physicians 600 Indocet, which is a highly addictive opiate, and he was also getting 360 OxyContin. None of those doctors knew that the other doctors had signed contracts. This gentleman was in a lot of trouble. He came into Springbrook. We treated him, and he was in aftercare for quite a while. He ended up leaving again, going back into society. And, of course, we always hope that when they go out that they stay straight. The reality of it is if we get 50%, we're thrilled to death. This gentleman, all of a sudden, we started getting phone calls from family members saying he was acting strange. We had no way to find out where he was going, what he was doing. The reality of it is that he died of a drug overdose. And had we been able to maybe at least know where he was going and what he was doing and been able to talk to the family, and we might have been able to intervene on him. And this doesn't happen once or twice in a lifetime. This happens once or twice in a month. And it gets really frustrating from where we sit. The second one we had was a guy that was calling in prescriptions. This guy was very smooth. And this was back when the board still had a list of people who were, they thought, maybe writing their own prescriptions, and they had reports from different pharmacies throughout the state. And they used to circulate that among us. And I looked at my list, and I saw this name on there. And it was not the same name, but it was similar. And this guy was so smooth on the phone, I thought, you know, there's something wrong. The guy came to my pharmacy to pick up his prescription. We had it ready, but we also had called the police because I had called the physician, and the physician said, no, he didn't even know who this person was. And to show you that addiction is involved with people of all states of life and all professions, this gentleman was an ex-legislator. And when he was arrested, he had in the back of his car 300 bottles of Vicodin and a submachine gun. That's one time when I was glad I knew. I had an idea this guy was up to no good, so I was, you know, I had police there, and I had an opportunity. And those are the kinds of things that we deal with. Can we save everybody? No, we can't. Do we try? Absolutely. And the reality of it is that at this particular time, in the state of Oregon, in the United States, Canada, it doesn't really matter where you go, we have a lot of problems, especially with addictions. And we don't have enough people to help all the people that are involved. And when you think about it, we only save about 50% in the facilities I work in. We get 62 patients per month. 62, that's a lot of them. That means 31 of them don't make it. And there's only two choices. Either you make it or you die. And the second part of that is, and this is one of the reasons why I feel really, really strongly about it, is not only maybe the patient dies, but maybe he takes somebody with him. Same as drunk driving. Using drugs and driving is exactly the same thing. There is no difference. It's just the amount of liquid is different. We had a young man who went off Highway 22 just outside of Mill City at 94 miles an hour after consuming large amounts of OxyContin. Now, the reality of it is that he could have killed somebody. He didn't even kill himself, which was incredible. But those are the kinds of things we're looking at. We're looking at dollars that are wasted in our health profession for people who are working physicians, dollars that are wasted in the pharmacy sector for the same thing, and the cost of lives of independent people who have nothing to do with it, and the loss of lives of those who are the abusers. So that is why I am in favor of this bill. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Just a quick question. I truly believe we have a drug epidemic, and people who are drug addicted truly need help. I still have a question regarding when someone comes and you find that he's on the list, you cannot fulfill this. What recourse does that patient have in case? To me, it would be nice if his physician was told that he was on the list, and that then his physician could talk to him regarding getting into treatment whatever circumstance is.
Well,
with this bill, it just cuts it off, and there's...
Well, not really, because basically what it does is it gives us an information stream that we can make a professional decision to call the physicians. And to be honest with you right now, if I have somebody who's a regular customer who's using too much, and I start getting kind of uneasy about it, the first thing I do is I call the physician. And I said, now, are you aware? Now, if I see multiple doctors, then it becomes my responsibility as a pharmacist, as a health care provider, to talk to the patient to find out what's going on. And usually what happens is the stories start coming out. When the stories start coming out, then I go to the physicians and say, you know, we have a problem. Family members generally will get involved, you know, and hopefully we get interventions. We do, at Hazelden Springbrook, we do about 9 interventions a month. And those aren't fun, by the way. But family members, a lot of times, are really heavily impacted. And sometimes they're so heavily impacted, they become sicker than the patient. And that's really sad. There's an old saying around Hazelden, original Hazelden people out of Minneapolis said, bring us your alcoholic, we'll fix him in 3 days. Bring us the family, and it'll take us a couple of months. And there's some reality in it. So it's really compounded by the fact that this disease is really incredibly convoluted. And if you don't work in the field, it's very, very difficult to see how convoluted it is. I mean, you and I sit here and we think about people taking 600 Indocet in a month with a contract on it. I couldn't drive across the street with 600. I probably couldn't get the car started. But these people are almost functional, but they make bad decisions. And we have another saying in treatment. We say, you know, it's not bad people. It's just a bad disease. And our job is basically to let them know that there's an opportunity to make a change. But there's no guarantees.
Thank you. Now, where did you say McMinnville?
No, Newburgh.
Newburgh.
Yeah, McMinnville's the Grizzlies. They're our arch rival. Don't ever say McMinnville. That's bad.
Newburgh.
Yeah. Gee, that was close.
Well, that's nice.
Any other question?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. How many days do you keep a person at Springbrook?
How many what?
Days. How many days do they stay at Springbrook?
You know, if I was right now recruiting you to come to Springbrook, I'd tell you 30 days. The reality of it is it's 60 to 90. We had an Irish lady that was there a year and 6 months.
And you continue to keep people past the 90 days?
We put them in a halfway house. We have halfway houses.
I see.
And they keep coming back for further counseling. And we do a lot of professional people, so we'll put them in a halfway house and send them, like, for instance, physicians, we'll send them to OHSU, and they will get kind of back in the swing of things slowly and still have that crutch of coming back to counseling when the stress and... gets to them. It's a process that Hazelden started 100 years ago, not quite, but you know, in the early 40s, and they started with the halfway houses so that these people could learn how to work again and how to cope with life on life's terms rather than using something to alter their thinking.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But you actually continue with them in the program, learning the skills and tools that they need when they get on the outside for up to 90 days.
Up to 90 days, and then they are on what we call aftercare. They'll come in for 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. And they'll come in like once or twice a month. We check and see how they're doing, and we also have the families. All the treatment facilities now are doing family week. And at that time, we bring the families in to talk to the patients or talk to us to find out how to handle certain situations. We give them as much information as we can because we find out that they're our best advocate. And some of them, you know, we call them black belt. They really know when things start going wrong. That's one of the reasons why we know they we know that something not right is happening, but we don't have any system to find out if they are seeking drugs in other places. And, you know, alcohol is really just, it's the same thing as drugs. It's just, it's in liquid form, basically. So that's what makes it really complex.
Thank you
very much.
We have two individuals who have come over 100 miles. Marty Newlander and Robert Pearson. I think we spoke in Coos Bay, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Welcome, Marty.
Thank you, Senator. Chairman Morissette and members of the subcommittee, I just want to first and foremost thank you for the opportunity to be here to speak as just one voice of a pain patient of the experiences that we go through on a daily basis. When we have chronic pain, it's 24/7. We don't get a dial to turn off the pain. Different things will set it off at any time. My wife, who used to be very active up until 10 years ago, she's 46 now, which is rather young. She suffers from fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, degenerative disc disease, both in the cervical and lumbar areas. She also suffers from migraine headaches and has chronic fatigue syndrome. And yeah, that's a lot. It's been 10 years, pretty rough. A lot of times when we go to meet with the doctors, a lot of times they don't believe the amount of pain meds that she's on. Sometimes the pain meds don't even manage the pain, so we'll end up in the emergency room. And I've literally had to argue with the doctors to get them to understand this is the amount that she actually is prescribed to take. There isn't a machine where we get to back her up, hook her up, and it says your pain level's at a 10 or a 2, unlike the heart monitors. So it becomes very frustrating, and what will happen is they'll prescribe a very low dose of Valium or some of the other medications that they'll do through a shot. Sometimes it's been a pill, but it'll be a very small amount that doesn't even touch it. And so we'll sit there, and they come back 20 minutes or half an hour later. How's your pain? It's as bad as when I first got here. Well, there's been no relief? No, there's no relief because you haven't given enough medication to help get rid of the high amount of pain. We had an experience, and we live in Coos Bay, North Bend, which is a very small rural community. We love it there, but the doctors tend to see people in the community. We had one ER doctor at one time told us point blank, my license is not worth prescribing the medication you need to take care of your pain. He gave her a shot of Benadryl, sent her home, and told her to sleep it off. Now, as a husband, I won't tell you what went through my mind. But it's hard. It's frustrating. And every time we would go into these situations, I would argue. I would fight trying to get her help. And when you're taking your wife in, she has sunglasses on. She hasn't been out of bed for 3 or 4 days because the pain level gets to a point that she can't function anymore. And as a husband, you're helpless. You don't know what to do. But you try to seek the avenue, which is medical help, which these doctors are supposed to provide us. Up until about 3 years ago, I became involved in a motor vehicle accident. And I have a lot of problems in my upper cervical area right below the brainstem. I live with chronic pain every day now, too. That's two of us. It's tough in our household to try to get adequate medical attention. When my prescribing pain doctor is on vacation, and this has happened to me, in a clinic of approximately 50 to 60 doctors that have access to my records, not a single one of them would prescribe a refill for me. I get a 30-day prescription. At the end of the 30 days, that's it. I need a new prescription. Not a one. My doctor was gone for 3 weeks. Since that experience, we've learned to try to plan ahead, and my doctor has helped us with that. But it's very frustrating when you're a victim of chronic pain to go through what you go through. I don't know how many of you have had a broken arm or whatever, the doctor can see it, but they can't see how the chronic pain affects you emotionally, physically, psychologically. All we want to do is be viable people in the community. And we're just a basket case because of the pain we're under. Because everybody is afraid of all the ramifications if they prescribe something. I went in for a shot last week. Fortunately, my wife called a doctor that knew our case history, and she called the emergency room ahead of time, and they wheeled me right in and gave me a shot of 150 milligrams of a particular medication, which is unheard of for a lot of ER doctors to begin with. But it was what was needed to get me that relief. With Senate Bill 34, it provides an avenue for those doctors that don't know us to be able to look and see, no, this person isn't... I'm sorry, my mouth is getting a little dry. Excuse me for 1 second. Thank you. With Senate Bill 34, we look at this as a viable tool to allow us to have the medical treatment that the doctors have promised to give us without having to go through the hour or 2 hour long hoops just to get them to finally believe us. And I would urge you that, ladies and gentlemen, as a private citizen in the state of Oregon, I urge you to pass 34, because I have and my wife has nothing to hide, but we have everything to gain. Thank you very much for allowing me to address you today.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you. Karen Wheeler, would you come up, please, from Department of Human Services?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Senator Morissette. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Manager for the Department of Human Services, Addictions and Mental Health Division. There are two reasons that the department supports Senate Bill 34. First of all, a growing number of Oregonians are addicted to prescription medication, and most concerning, more youth every day are becoming involved in prescription medications, non-medical use of prescription medications. And as you've heard before, undoubtedly, people who become addicted to these medications engage in doctor shopping and pharmacy hopping in a desperate attempt to get their medications or their drugs. We believe this bill would provide an additional tool for medical practitioners to alert them to the fact that their people are doctor shopping and pharmacy hopping and intervene in this pattern of behavior. The rate of non-medical use of pain relievers in Oregon is higher than the national average. A particular concern, 9.8% of Oregon youth between the ages of 12 and 17 have engaged in non-medical use of pain relievers in the past year compared to 7.5 nationally. And currently, Channel 2 is doing a story on this that will be aired pretty soon.
Excuse me. Channel 2 is doing a story on?
On youth abuse of prescription medication.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. Thank you.
And as of 2006, actually more people over the age of 12 are initiating abuse of prescription medication at a higher rate than marijuana. The second reason that we support Senate Bill 34 is that Congress passed Public Law 109-60 on August 11th of 2005. The law states, beginning 3 years after the date on which funds are appropriated to carry out this section, and this refers to the grant program established to establish prescription drug monitoring programs as described in the Act, the Secretary, in awarding any competitive grant that is related to drug abuse as determined by the Secretary, and for which only states are eligible to apply, shall give preference to any state with an application approved under this section. Thus, without a prescription drug monitoring program, Oregon will be less competitive when applying for federal grants to reduce drug use in Oregon. And these are discretionary competitive grants.
Could you quantify that?
I was thinking about my 3 years of being a manager at DHS, and we've applied for at least 10 competitive grants in those 3 years. We are currently operating with one. It's about $3 million grant. But periodically, when money becomes available from the federal government, we do like to apply for discretionary grant programs.
Chair. Yes. And these are all SAMHSA grants?
Chair Morissette, that's correct.
Okay.
I guess I, not only the number of grants, but the amount of money. What does that translate into?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, currently, at any given time, Oregon has about $17 million coming into the state from discretionary grants from SAMHSA. Not all of those grants are to the department. Counties are eligible to apply for some. Private nonprofit organizations are eligible to apply. And the amount fluctuates year by year depending on the budget passed by Congress. But at any given time, there's around $17 million coming in to Oregon.
Thank you. Seeking drug free stuff like that. So.
Okay. No. Go ahead.
That concludes my comments. Thank you very much. If you have any questions.
Other questions? Yes. Senator Virgil.
Yes. I don't want to put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you a question you may not can answer today. But I'd like to know, which states have the lowest drug use?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, there's a publication I was just reviewing before I came into the hearing, and there are five states that have low rates of prescription drug abuse, and all five of those states have a prescription drug monitoring program, and I can get you the list of five states at a later time.
Was that your question?
Yeah. Well, my question was probably broader than that, but that's fine.
And Chair Morissette, I can also get you that information too.
Okay. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen, I'm troubled by this, and you know, you always try to put the thing in the scale and balance it out. We just heard from an individual with chronic pain, and you know, between my back and a few other things, I've been to that point. I'm the most anti-drug person you've ever met. But when it gets to a certain point, you're saying, give me something, give it to me now. And you literally cannot function from the standpoint of the operation of your mind because you're in such pain. It literally begins to blank out everything else because the body's trying to deal with that level of pain. What about the balance between a person not being, maybe you have a very, very conservative group of doctors that say, I think that's too much for this individual. And so that person could force them to shop it someplace to get to the pain relief. And I raised that the first time we were here was, you know, the very famous person who fell into that trap, who did fall into a case of addiction and then began to shop, allegedly shop. Where's our balance on this thing? How do we address chronic pain? Because I can remember a few years ago in the building, nobody would admit that there was such a thing, but you haven't walked in those moccasins. And at that time, I didn't understand it. Now I do.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for that question. I, too, suffer from migraine headaches, and I have a limited supply of my medication. Then I have to go back to my doctor, and he has to check and make sure I'm still alive and still have migraines and still need the same medication. So I think there is a balance. Fortunately, I don't suffer from chronic pain. But I, in my personal life, when I'm not working, I associate with many people who have addictions, who are in recovery, also people who've struggled very, very hard with prescription medication. It's a very tough one. There is a balance. I think the prescription drug monitoring program is one tool, while another tool is educating physicians and educating the medical community about chronic pain, about addiction. And I think, in my opinion, we need to do both. We need to have a, as you said, a balanced approach, and there needs to be both.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Chairman,
yes.
To kind of answer to Senator George, that's one of the reasons we created the Pain Commission was to help change the culture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Actually, the main reason.
in a minute. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Kathy Hunt, could you come up, please, and introduce yourself and comment properly on the record?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I am Kathy Hahn, chair of the Pain Commission. Our two main functions of the Pain Commission right now are to vigorously support the 7 hours of mandatory pain education that we are requiring of all healthcare professionals, and we do have a bill this session that's adding the people that we forgot, the dentists, the occupational therapists, and the physical therapists. So we pretty much have covered every conceivable healthcare professional that needs education and pain management. Mm-hmm. And this would be something that we're hoping helps them understand that patients have rights and that they have to be able to treat pain. But we are also giving them, hopefully, a tool to balance out their fear of, you know, who's the pain patient and who's the drug seeker. Yeah. So between these two actions, we're hoping to really make a difference in the state, but we need both.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Kathy, how could you have missed dentists, for God's sakes? They're incredibly painful.
Chair Morissette, committee, we're very sorry, and we're making up for it.
Dr. Pearson, would you come up, please?
Thank you, sir, and the rest of the committee. I didn't quite get as organized today as I did last time, so I'm a little bit more informal. Thank you for letting me come back. I wanted to have a chance to share a few additional thoughts that I'd had since I was here last time, and I guess provide some counterpoints.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Dr. Robert Peterson. I'm from Astoria. I'm the medical director at Coastal Family Health Center, a federally qualified health center.
Thank you.
In Astoria in Clatsop County. There were some interesting points made earlier by other speakers that I would like to expand on a little bit. One person talked about a number of drugs that were perhaps, I got the feeling that the person talking about them thought that they weren't all that serious drugs and we shouldn't be excited about them being databased, Ambien, Ritalin, and codeine. Yet these are all very easily and unfortunately commonly abused drugs, and they are available in our schools. Only just two quick examples. In the military, in both Afghanistan and Iraq, where I've been, a lot of the soldiers have to go and then stop at uneven hours. And it became an easy practice to provide them with Ambien when they were done with their mission so they could finally get some sleep, because they were pretty racked up on this. And unfortunately, in some places, that became a little bit more easily prescribed than others, and we ran into a big problem with people becoming addicted to Ambien or showing addictive behavior with it. It's not a benign drug. Ritalin is a very easily abused drug, and unfortunately, a lot of the people that are appropriately prescribed it have been known to share it with their friends, both in grade school and in college. It's not an unheard of practice. If they have a legitimate diagnosis and they're obtaining the medication from multiple sources, it's a lot easier for them to do that. With a bill like this in place, it's a lot harder for them to do that, and maybe it will provide them with a little bit of a deterrent effect from taking a step down the wrong road there. So I don't think we should look lightly on those particular drugs and consider the fact that if they're going to be in the database, that's a bad thing. I think that's a good thing. Definitely, we need more money for drug treatment, but that's not what this bill is about, and I'm more than willing to listen to anybody that has some positive recommendations for that, but I don't think this is the place to carry on about that. I see two kinds of patients that I worry about where the information that could be made available to me will help me. Well, actually three. Now, the patients with chronic pain, as we've already heard, and if I have this information available to me either in the clinic or if I'm seeing the patient in the emergency room, it's a lot easier for me to verify their stories and come up with an appropriate dose of medication for them. I'm comfortable with using 150 milligrams of the D drug if I know somebody has developed a lot of experience with medications, which can be obvious from looking at their prescription patterns. I'm not very comfortable giving 50 milligrams to people that aren't. So that can be a very useful information for us, and it can actually speed treatment of patients in an emergent situation. So I have a hard time understanding the folks that think that having the database available to us is going to cause problems for chronic pain patients. I think it's going to actually help them. But besides those, I'm worried about patients that abuse the medication. They're receiving it, at least initially, legitimately, but they develop an addiction pattern to the use of the drug and can abuse it. I'm also concerned about folks that don't take the drugs at all and simply sell them and divert them. And sometimes these are one and the same, but more than often they're two separate types of individuals. Again, the availability of this kind of information to me in the office when I see the patient makes it a lot easier for me to decide whether what I'm doing is the right thing for the patient or not, and whether I'm putting them in danger by giving them a large prescription or narcotic, or whether I'm helping them. Right now, I have to guess, and I don't think that's fair to the patient. Yes, it does put my license on the line when I do these prescriptions, and there are some physicians that are very uncomfortable with that. I think there'll be fewer physicians that are uncomfortable if they have this information available to them. The Pain Commission will have to work on the rest. Those were the main points that came to mind that I don't think I covered last time, but I'd be willing to answer any questions if anybody has any of me at this point.
Okay. Sure. Thank you for coming all the way from Astoria to add that clarity. That was well stated.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Janet Preller, would you come up, please?
Chairman Morissette, Vice Chairman Cruz, and distinguished members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today regarding Senate Bill 34. And thank you, Andrea, for your testimony, as the ACLU does good and important work. My name is Janet Preller. I'm the risk manager of the Corvallis Clinic. It's a large primary care and multi-specialty clinic in the Willamette Valley. We have 80 providers. We serve 33,000 patient visits a month. The last time I spoke here, I spoke about the 300-plus patients that are referred to me annually from our providers asking for assistance in determining whether a patient is a legitimate chronic pain patient, whether they're drug seeking, perhaps drug diverting. And that's because of the prevalence of prescription drug abuse in our society. 2006 totals, I had 424 patients referred to me. So you can see the jump from the year prior. Prescription drug abuse and diversion is not unique to our clinic or our community. It's a growing challenge facing medical providers, families, schools, and lawmakers in Oregon and throughout the nation. And addressing this challenge necessitates partnerships between local, state, and federal governments, as well as with pharmacies and healthcare practitioners, like those I'm representing here today. The ACLU is correct in that our efforts to reduce prescription drug abuse must be balanced with the importance of several other important policy considerations, including the preservation of patient privacy and the respect of legitimate practice of medicine, including the freedom of physicians to prescribe legitimate medications based on their best professional judgment. The ACLU testified that Senate Bill 34 would interfere with the doctor-patient relationship. I strongly disagree. Senate Bill 34 stands only to enhance this relationship between doctor and patient. Physicians will have needed information through this bill that will assist them in making informed decisions. Senate Bill 34 provides an avenue to, one, reassure physicians of legitimate chronic pain patients so they don't wrongly fall under suspicion or become wrongly labeled, and two, it identifies and provides intervention opportunities to those patients who are addicted to controlled substances. And it allows an opportunity in the early stages of a disease for intervention, when, like many diseases, it's most curable. There is one relationship that could suffer, indeed, by interference by Senate Bill 34, and that is the relationship between the physician and the clear criminal who could not possibly be taking all they're receiving from other providers. And it's overwhelmingly clear from the number of providers that he or she is diverting these drugs to the street for profit. The ACLU testified that creating such a database would treat all Oregonians as potential drug seekers. The sad reality is this. If you are a new patient to a practice and you require controlled substances, you are, in the physician's mind, a potential drug seeker until they get to know you, and that is either through personal experience or acquired previous records. This database would provide useful information at the ready needed in establishing that physician-patient rapport. Next, I don't understand the argument that Senate Bill 34 would create yet one more database in which personal information exists out there. Pharmacy information is already stored on databases with insurance companies, and pharmacy information is already stored with individual pharmacies and pharmacy chains. For example, our physicians can call Rite Aid and get what a patient has filled at any Rite Aid throughout the nation. What Senate Bill 34 does is ensures the integrity of the information through a unique identifier, perhaps the last four digits of a Social Security number, not the full number. And it delivers the information in a usable format to the hands of those providing direct care to patients. In my mind, this information is as critical diagnostically as laboratory information is to the physician regarding a diabetic patient. We can't go back now and eliminate technology. That ship has sailed, and I'm reminded of that every time I have to use three remotes to operate my DVD player. But what we can do is put measures in place to ensure that our databases containing sensitive information are used legitimately and responsibly. The good news is that we are not recreating the wheel, but we can draw from the experience and the wisdom from the greater alliance of states that have already implemented such a program. The ACLU would like you to believe that the sky is falling at the very idea of Senate Bill 34. Well, they're right that the sky is falling. It's falling down around all of the pain patients throughout our state who desperately need informed providers to ensure that they get the care that they need and deserve. It's falling down around the well-meaning but addicted patients who started out medicating a legitimate pain circumstance but couldn't get off the pain medication and yet now have no idea how to have that conversation with their physician. The information in this database is a starting point. When will the doctor find out that they are one of but many providers prescribing for that patient? After the patient's lost their job, their home, their spouse, after perhaps they've lost their life? With Senate Bill 34, there are no losers. I would like to see the ACLU come to the table and help ensure those things that they're concerned about. Thank you. Do you have any questions for
me? That was very compelling. Thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I go into Rite Aid and I purchased a pharmaceutical, how do they enter the data? What do they record? My name, my address, birth date, and do they use Social Security?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay.
If our provider provided a name and a date of birth, and so that's what I mean by ensuring the integrity of the information, you could imagine with common names nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Right.
Yeah, because we had a Gary George who was a psychiatrist at the prison. It wasn't me. You know, I would have told him get straight. That would have been the end of the conversation.
Oh.
But anyway.
Is that where you met him?
That would have get straight. But anyway, the bottom line is, I don't know why you can't pick any kind of number and maybe that would become your identifier. But there's no mechanism whatsoever in order for that to be abused in order to take advantage with identity theft of that individual. Why not do something like that that does not include all of our other information? Because I've actually removed my name from websites and even agency information because of the fact they gave out too much information. And because, you know, at our job, you have to worry about that kind of issue.
Sure.
People do today, too, because if I capture your identity, there's no limit to what can be done to you. Talk about harm and talk about a need for medication is when you are in the middle of a identity theft situation and you're under tremendous stress of all kinds mm-hmm. on your bank account and your family and everything else. Is I see somebody wanting to come up here and talk. But the main thing is I don't see anything in the bill that would prevent, first of all, that from happening. But the other thing is I think it should be prescribed that it would be an alternative number to make sure that we are protecting that individual. Because here's what would be the question. Let me give you, if I could, give my scenario. He's ignoring me. Number one, you come into my pharmacy, or I'm a doctor, and I said, have you ever had a prescription before? And you say, well, yes, I have. Can I see your identifier number? Okay. Then I would take your number, which had nothing to do with your date of birth or where you live or anything else, and I would enter that into the system. And it would pop up and tell me if you are who you said you were. But at that point, if anybody broke into that system, as ACLU is rightfully considering, okay, the potential is too high. Why not use an alternative number? Because you used a unique identifier in your speech, and I think that may be a great idea.
Chairman Morissette and members of the committee, I think your questions are all very legitimate. There is a governance board that will be making those decisions, and it's a matter of defining who will be at the table. But I respect Andrea and the work that she does and the ACLU. I think those are legitimate concerns. I do think that they're things that need to be considered and certainly not things that the bill should go down on, because they can definitely be worked through. And I think that the Board of Pharmacy could speak.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The Alliance, these are not new issues for the Alliance, and I attended the last year's Alliance conference and learned quite a bit. I felt like little old me in Corvallis was facing this problem all on my own and learned how this is a nationwide problem and was very encouraged by the states that have taken measures. So I'm going to defer,
okay,
with your permission.
Maybe. I thank you very much, and we will hear from Dan in just a minute. We are going to have, and I think you mentioned it, a governing board or a database advisory commission, as we are, and that hasn't been mentioned in all the discussions that we've had. And the commission, well, first of all, will not have a fiscal impact because it's going to be handled by the Board of Pharmacy, and they're not going to compensate people for travel and so on. And the commission will consider such things as removal of names. Or at what point will you stop gathering information on a particular person? That would be one instance. We do have an amendment that would forbid the use of a Social Security number as such. Now, you mentioned the last four digits. We didn't deal with that. But I have several PIN numbers that I use on my national accounts that I have. And a PIN number, I think, is something, it is a possibility that might be used as an identifier that would be a unique number picked by the person that, is, you know, would be not trackable. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dana, would you like to comment?
Senator Morissette, thank you for allowing me to respond a little bit more to Senator George's question. When a patient comes into a pharmacy, they are already required by law to, the pharmacy must collect the patient's name, their address, their date of birth. We don't collect any additional information for a prescription monitoring program. It's in Ohio, we use the name, address, date of birth, and telephone number. While that, we recognize that those things change sometimes as people move, there we have intelligent software that can deal with most of those problems. It's not necessary to have a Social Security number. Also, the federal government keeps talking about issuing patients a national health care identifier. So it's probably good to have that possibility of using that if that ever comes into place in your law. So there's something there that doesn't have all this other information for identity theft with it, but we don't know when that might ever occur. But it's not necessary to have a number like a Social Security number in order to operate an effective program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the reason we added the amendment that would forbid the use of a Social Security number is to make sure that that does not happen. And that was a concern that was raised, and so that, you know, that will be part of the bill. That will not happen.
And I think that's a wise decision. I would never recommend that a state use Social Security numbers in a program like this.
Senator George.
Is Rite Aid required to disclose that if you go into any Rite Aid and get a prescription, that in fact that will become part of a database that's nationwide?
Are they required to disclose
your
other prescriptions?
Well, no. Because mainly, you know, I would want to know that. If you're going to track anything that I would be doing, you can go out to my car out in the driveway and it says no tolling or tracking my car. So I'm a little bit sensitive about the issue. What you do is your business, what I do is mine. Now, I do no criminal activity, so I don't have a thing to worry about. But let me tell you the main thing. I want to make sure that if somebody is doing this kind of thing, that they would put something up that would say, by the way, you are being tracked. I think it might be a deterrent, but it also would help me to understand that, you know, in fact, your numbers are being accumulated. That's why I think it's so important that it not be a number that could be identified with the location of that person, their address, driver's license, you know, any of those kind of things, particularly Social Security.
And I believe you have a provision in your bill that requires notification to patients that the information is being collected and goes into this state program.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably unique in the country, but it will be. I think it's a good measure. While all state laws are public laws and people should have access to know, that's another step to let people know what's going on.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
Do you have any idea whether or not all of the drugs that are on the illicit market that are normal pharmaceutical-type products, whether they're all generated from the abuse of the system, or is there another market out there, a gray market, a black market, that in fact is dealing with large quantities of this stuff being smuggled into the country?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I suspect that it's a combination of everything. The information that we keep getting is that a large amount of the drugs on the sold on the street and diverted and that are in our schools do come from physicians' prescriptions. However, there are drugs that come from thefts of pharmacies. We do know that there are drugs smuggled in from other countries as well. It's hard to put a figure on those quantities because this is illegal activity.
Could I make a point relative to that? If a person breaks into the pharmacy and they're going to take the drugs, why not take the computer with all the database? We have many times people that are involved in illicit drug activity also in the identity theft business. So it would only make sense that they would grab that computer. And I think that's one more reason why we need to isolate this so I can't identify you, other than the fact that I know you're so-and-so because of this code number. Only that idea.
It seems to me the Veterans Administration has a computer system that will provide information, your information, to any veterans hospital in the country. That's part of the electronic transmission of records that is starting to happen. That, and I would say it, so if you're in an auto accident, if you're not a veteran, and you're in an auto accident in Washington, D.C., and they find out where you're from, can they get your records electronically from your local McMinnville Triad Hospital? Probably.
Mm-hmm. They can.
Probably.
Yeah.
So records are available.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Kind of in response to Senator George, you know, if somebody wanted to break in and take a pharmacy's computer, they could do it now and get all that information. So this doesn't create a unique opportunity for that to happen. I don't think we can create a program that is that we can protect everything from that sort of activity. So I don't think this is unique, or this creates a unique situation from that scenario. If somebody's going to break in and they want to, I mean, they can steal the paper records as far as that goes and get the same sort of information. So.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Dana. Thank you. Claudia Black and Sheila Holmes. Sheila Holmes Shields. If you would both come up and. Probably unrelated comments.
That's true.
Would you like to go first, and we'll save Claudia until.
Okay.
You don't get beat up on her after.
We'll beat up on Claudia after.
Don't beat up on me either. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, it's a real pleasure to be presenting in front of you. And my name is Shelda Holmes Shields. I'm a family nurse practitioner and an Oregon Nurse Association member. I'm also an active member of the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. And just to give a little bit of background, I'm firstly very much in favor and supporting Senate Bill 34. I've been looking forward to this opportunity to be a better clinician for a very long time, and I do think it's a tool to help me be a better clinician. A little background on myself. I come to being a nurse practitioner. There's been a lot of talk about physicians that I too prescribe as a nurse practitioner. And I come to being a nurse practitioner from an oncology background. I am young enough to actually have been fed nursing that goes something along the lines of, you know, pain is the fifth vital sign. And I do believe that very much as a former oncology nurse. I also have some experience with alcohol and drug treatment, both personal experience in my family, and I'll share a brief story about that, and as a clinician working at the Urban Indian Clinic, NARA, Native American Rehabilitation Association, where we have inpatient drug and alcohol treatment and an outpatient clinic. So we've heard a lot about chronic pain and the potential benefit here for treating folks with chronic pain better, and I very much support those arguments that have been made. We also understand that there's diversion and addiction, and this bill certainly isn't going to address all those problems. But we can't cure addiction with this bill, but that's not its intent. The intent is really to help clinicians make better decisions. I would like to reiterate that time and time again, I am faced with a new patient who has potentially a very valid claim to chronic pain, but I one-eye every single patient that's new to me. Every single patient. And while I really appreciate the art and science of being a clinician, it really is it's a balance. I would like to take the guesswork out. And in so much as this bill can help me do that, I'm excited. I'm really, truly excited. I started my own primary care practice in the fall of 2005, December 24th, the day before Christmas. It's a Saturday. I intentionally have hours on the weekends and on off hours because it addresses working people's needs. And on December 24th, I ended up prescribing a Vicodin prescription to a patient. December 28th, I received a phone call from OHSU's ICU that this patient had attempted suicide through an overdose on my prescription and five other prescribers that had prescribed to him in 4 days from five different pharmacies. And I spent the rest of my holiday praying that he was going to be okay. He was, gratefully. But the resources that I usually use to sleuth and research about new patients to me were not available to me. I often will call pharmacies in the neighborhood where I'm prescribing, which, by the way, takes a great deal of time and energy. And as a small family practice, I certainly don't have the time to be doing this. But I do get some information from pharmacists. It's a very uncomfortable position I understand that I've put them in, asking them to divulge information that they may or may not feel appropriate sharing with me. But I ask them anyways, is this a familiar person to you? Who are the other prescribers? Do you happen to have their phone numbers? So this is one resource I use that wasn't available to me this particular incident. And another resource I use are the healthcare insurance companies who do keep databases on the prescriptions that their patients use because they pay for them. So this is one story, and I know that you've heard countless stories, and if you keep your ears open, you'll continue to hear countless stories. The other story is much more personal, and that is my brother is in recovery. He has two years and 4 months under his belt from meth addiction, meth and Vicodin, I might add. When he was finally kicked out of our family house, which he was residing in by himself, we found two cupboards full of empty Vicodin containers. Most of them were prescribed to him. Some of them were prescribed to other people, but most of them were prescribed to him from various providers. And then I had to go use my authority and power to call these prescription, the folks that were writing prescriptions to him, and put them in a very awkward position where I was flexing my muscle as a cohort to convince them to stop prescribing to him. And this is not uncommon. It's not an uncommon story. It just happens to be my personal story. So I just, to complement some of the previous testimony, would like to say that, indeed, having a database like this will not solve our identity theft problem, but it may actually help in some surprising ways, in so much as I know for a fact that there are patients who steal prescriptions from each other, and also steal medications. And therefore, I've had valid chronic pain patients going through their medications far more quickly than I had ever anticipated. And I've been able to, because at NAR we have our own pharmacy that we use, just one pharmacy, so we can control this a little bit better. But I've been able to say, look, you're going through this much more quickly than we had planned. It's against your contract. What's really going on here? Well, my, nephew is stealing from me and has an addiction problem. So I think there might be some unexpected ways that we actually find that we can help there. And lastly, as a small business owner, I am more than happy to subsidize this sort of database over the long term. The amount of money it will save me in time is worth some sort of fee tacked onto my license. I volunteer. I know that we haven't quite worked out some of those logistics, but it's you may not always hear that from other clinicians. But as a nurse practitioner, I totally appreciate, and I get paid 2/3 of what a physician does. But anyhow, but I'm more than happy to pay any sort of fee I need to, because it's really about patient care. You know, I can be very reserved and protective and defensive even about my liability, about the clinical practice I engage in. I don't want to lose my house, you know. But what it really comes down to is patient care. And this will provide me with another tool, a very important tool, a quantifiable tool, instead of me just one-eyeing patients, you know. And taking that guesswork out of my assessment would be very, very helpful. So I look forward to utilizing this database and improving my practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure, it's just interesting that nurse practitioners are more willing to participate than the doctors are. I just think, we haven't heard that yet.
Yeah. Really. Thank you very much. And then you may wonder why it's all grouped together, right?
I feel like I've been set up.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here representing the Oregon Medical Association. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on SB 34 today. The OMA supports SB 34 with the -1 and -3 amendments, which were discussed in the last hearing. Physicians in Oregon prescribe medications on a daily basis with anticipation that patients will take them as prescribed and appropriately. Many of the prescriptions are for substances that have a high abuse potential. And we know that patients can be addicted to medication and can also sell prescriptions on the street for a huge profit. Right now, we don't have any system to ensure that prescriptions are being filled and taken by the patient for whom they were prescribed. And neither do we have a system to identify patients who may become addicted and go to many doctors for the same prescription. We also know that the system is being abused by people who go to multiple physicians, getting multiple prescriptions and getting them filled at multiple pharmacies and then selling the drugs on the street. We know that's happening. So the intent of the registry, as we understand it, is to help ensure that those patients who need medication can get it and protect those physicians who prescribe the medications from accusations that they are overprescribing. And once the registry is up and running real time, we think it'll be a benefit for physicians to be able to access the information about their patients' prescriptions, reducing the likelihood that patients can abuse the system. We are happy to hear all the assurances about the registry being confidential, the information being controlled, and preventing unauthorized searches of the database. Oregon has a similar program in place right now, the Immunization Alert Registry, and that's been working very well. And so basically, when a child goes into a pediatrician's office to get a vaccine, the pediatrician can look it up on the system to see whether that child's already received the vaccine. The registry is voluntary for both physicians and clinics, and a physician who orders a vaccine in good faith but has not queried the registry for whatever reason is not held liable for ordering a vaccine. Likewise, physicians do not pay a fee for this system to continue its operation or for using it. So the OMA strongly supports the -1 amendment to protect physicians from liability if the system is not queried prior to issuing a prescription. The OMA wants to assure that physicians are not held liable in any way for the use or non-use of the proposed Board of Pharmacy Controlled Substance Registry. We also understand that the initial cost of developing and implementing the registry, the program will be covered by grants for the first 2 years, maybe a little bit longer. And after the initial grant funding is expended, that the source of ongoing operational costs has not yet been identified. And although my co-presenter made it a bit difficult for me to talk about the -3 amendments, we are strongly supportive of them. And we would encourage the Board of Pharmacy to look for other options other than physicians to fund the database system. We believe that only a small percentage of physicians will even be using the system. And the immunization alert program that I talked about a little bit earlier
is funded by a private-public partnership that includes health plans, hospitals, Oregon Health Services, and the Division of Medical Assistance. Another suggestion is to fund the program by adding a penny to every single prescription that's filled in the state. So the Dash 3 amendment clarifies that physicians cannot be assessed a fee or charge to cover the ongoing costs of the operation of the database. So in summary, we like this system. We think it's going to be really useful in helping to prevent abuse of prescriptions, and we support the passage with the Dash 1 and the Dash 3 amendments. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm not sure I'd be happy to answer any questions.
you said a penny a prescription written and filled.
That's what Dr. Lace has recommended, that that's something that could be looked at.
So for every prescription that a physician writes, it would cost that physician one penny. And for and for everyone
we were
filled,
thinking more in terms
you,
of
we got
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
That's a great idea.
Okay. You're considering perhaps every insurance company would pay a penny, every patient would pay a penny.
Not just the doctors.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
the
I think you probably would not appreciate that amendment.
Okay.
question?
We're down here debating who's going to take the heat on my question. And I guess it's me.
You're going to do it.
In our presentation, we had who's going to use the system, and the answer was pharmacists, 27%, law enforcement, 8%, practitioners, 65%.
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty accurate?
Dan?
Don't ever give me numbers. You guys ought to know that much.
And go ahead and identify yourself again.
Dana Droz, I'm the Prescription Monitoring Administrator for the Ohio Board of Pharmacy. Central Morissette, Central George, you're correct. Those are the numbers that I presented from the Ohio program.
Mm-hmm.
However, if we look at a more mature program like Kentucky's program that's been in operation since 1999, the number of prescribers using that program in 2006 is 93%.
Ooh.
So we expect in Ohio that 61% to increase over time as our program matures. We've only been in operation since the 1st of October. So we definitely expect an increase, and that would be consistent with what a number of other states that have mature programs are reporting.
Thank you. Anything else?
Thanks, Gary. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Good. Thanks. Okay. Others wishing to testify? Yes, sir.
Senator Morissette, Chair, and members of the subcommittee. My name is Martin Kloss. Again, I'm a practitioner in Springfield, Oregon. I practice both pain management and addiction medicine. And I wanted I don't have a prepared statement today. I want to work through several misperceptions that I've heard so far. As far as the last speaker goes, I'm a member of the OMA, and I've never been polled, and I'll pay for this. There is a misperception from what I'm hearing from the senators that this bill would be a do not fill list. No practitioner, no physician, no pharmacist would look at it as such. That's not how we work with this. If we see a patient who's seeing multiple practitioners, again, Andrea from the ACLU mentioned that this might be thought of criminal activity on the patient's part. Physicians don't think of criminal activity. We think of medical problems. If we see a patient who shows up with multiple practitioners prescribing multiple medications, that patient has a potential, not necessarily, but a potential addiction problem. I understand the difficulty of doctor shopping for pain management. I see that all the time in patients that are referred to me. This bill would help us evaluate that patient. If a doctor saw a patient who's seeing multiple practitioners for opiate prescriptions, the first step he would take would be to send that patient to addiction evaluation. I get probably 5 to 15, depending on the year, patients referred to me from addiction programs who say this patient doesn't belong to me, he belongs to a pain specialist, not an addiction program. We get those referrals. Okay, so when the doctors perceive that, they have a place to go now. When Ms. Marlette from the ACLU was talking about suspected drug dealers. I've been in pain management in this state for 10 years. I've been doing this for 26 years total. In every pain management meeting that I go to, we are taught, we have DEA speakers, we have had the assistant head of the DEA come and talk to us. Every new patient who comes to my office is a suspected drug dealer or addict, period. I don't care what kind of records they've sent me, what kind of x-rays they've sent me. As a pain practitioner, I have been taught by our national police agencies to suspect that patient. This bill gives me the ability to look at that patient's prescriptions and say, no, we have a legitimate patient here. So as far as being a suspected drug user, every patient right now is that for any pain doctor out there. Ambien and Xanax, again, she mentioned these are minor medications. We have had fatal overdoses. We have had fatal interactions, particularly in the drug addiction field where I'm prescribing a drug like Suboxone for their addiction management. The patients, as she did say, many patients are reluctant to tell one physician what another physician is prescribing. I understand that, and I see that all the time. So my patients will go to another physician and say, you know, they won't even mention my treatment for addiction, but they'll say, I'm having problems with my anxiety. Get a prescription for Xanax, which has potentially fatal interactions with Suboxone. Again, patient safety is a big problem. Excuse me for a minute. I'm just going to go down here and look through real quickly. As far as databases go, we all know they're out there. We all know that this information is available. I can call any pharmacy if they're in a chain and find out everything that patient's getting. I can call Blue Cross, and they'll fax me a notice within minutes of everything that patient is on. I don't have to be a doctor to make that phone call. My staff can make that phone call. Anybody who's trained can make that phone call. Anybody who's heard it done before can make that phone call and pretend that they're calling from a doctor's office. That information is readily available on every patient, and it's easily available. I have not had to identify myself other than to say, I'm Dr. Claus from such and so, from Blue Cross. Would you please fax me this information? I can get it. So having a database that's protected is a little bit tighter program. As far as going to a 50-state database and working with, we talked about, Senator Morissette, you mentioned getting medical records from other doctors. We're not there yet. However, the new standards for electronic medical record keeping will allow us to do that within a very few years. So, yes, that information will be accessible from any doctor's office at any time. My new software has to do that. That's upgrades that we have to do. As far as getting a 50-state database, that would bring us up to the standard that Canada has been at for many years. Their program works well, functions well for their patients up there. And lastly, in my own defense, I have to state that Maggie Newlander has not been to the emergency room for several years under good pain management. The story was correct, but that was prior to her receiving good pain management. Any questions, ladies and gentlemen? Sorry.
He forgot to mention that part, didn't he?
He was going for the 10-year period.
Wow. Yes. What perfectly acceptable.
Her story was perfectly, that story was perfectly legitimate. It was just, it's just gotten better in the last 3 years.
Good.
Any further questions?
No. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here again, Dr. Claus. Okay. So seeing no other individual stepping forward, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 34, and we are adjourned. Thank you.